Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. Still coughing. Still got this awful cough. I'm still talking in this weird, pushed whisper. So I apologize. We're up to book 15, chapter 8. One would have thought that under the almost incredibly wretched conditions the Russian soldiers were in at the time, lacking warm boots and sheepskin coats, without a roof over their heads in the snow with 18 degrees of frost, which is the thermometer used in rumour, 18 degrees of frost equals 8 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, and without even full rations, the commissariat did not always keep up with the troops. They would have presented a very sad and depressing spectacle. On the contrary, the army had never, under the best material conditions, presented a more cheerful and animated aspect. This was because all who had begun to grow depressed or lost strength were sifted out of the army day by day. All the physically or morally weak had long since been left behind, and only the flower of the army, physically and mentally, remained. More men collected behind the wattle fence of the 8th Company than anywhere else. Two sergeant majors were sitting with them, and their campfire blazed brighter than the others. For leave to sit by their wattle, they demanded contributions of fuel. "Ah, Makiev, what has become of you, you son of a bitch? Are you lost, or have the wolves eaten you? Fetch some more wood," said he to another soldier. This red-haired man was neither a sergeant nor a corporal, but being robust, he ordered about those weaker than himself. The soldier they called Jack Dore, a thin little fellow with a sharp nose, rose obediently and was about to go, but at that instant there came into the light of the fire the slender, handsome figure of a young soldier carrying a load of wood. "Bring it here, that's fine." They split up the wood, pressed it down on the fire, blew at it with their mouths, and fanned it with the skirts of their great coats, making the flames hiss and crackle. The men drew nearer and lit their pipes, the handsome young soldier who had brought the wood, setting his arms akimbo, began stamping his cold feet rapidly and deftly on the spot where he stood. "Mother, the dew is cold but clear. It's well that I am a musketeer," he sang, pretending to hiccup after each syllable. "Look out, your souls will fly off," shouted the red-haired man, noticing that the sole of the dancer's boot was hanging loose. "What a fellow you are for dancing." The dancer stopped, pulled off the loose piece of leather and threw it on the fire. "Right enough, friend," said he, and having sat down, took out of his knapsack, a scrap of blue French cloth and wrapped it around his foot. "It's the steam that spoils them," he added, stretching out his feet towards the fire. "They'll soon be issuing us new ones. They say that when we've finished hammering them, we're to receive double kits. And that son of a bitch Petrov has lagged behind after all, it seems," said one sergeant major. "I've had an eye on him for this long while," said the other. "Well, he's a poor sort of soldier. But in the 3rd Company they say 9 men were missing yesterday." "Yes, it's all very well, but when a man's feet are frozen, how can he walk?" "Eh? Don't talk nonsense," said a sergeant major. "Do you want to be doing the same?" said an old soldier, turning reproachfully to the man who had spoken of frozen feet. "Well, you know," said the sharp-nosed man they called Jackdaw, in a squeaky and unsteady voice, raising himself at the other's side of the fire, "a plump man gets thin, but for a thin one it's death. Take me now. I've got no strength left," he added with sudden resolution, turning to the sergeant major. "Tell them to send me to hospital. I'm aching all over. Anyway, I shan't be able to keep up." That'll do," replied the sergeant major quietly. The soldier said no more, and the talk went on. What a lot of those Frenchies were taken today. And the fact that is that not one of them had what you might call real boots on, said a soldier, starting a new theme. They were no more than make-believes. The Cossacks have taken their boots. They were clearing the hut for the colonel and carried them out. It was pitiful to see them, boys, put in the dancer. As they turned them over, one seemed still alive, and would you believe it, he jabbered something in their lingo. But they're a clean folk, lads, the first man went on. He was white as birch bark, and some of them are such fine fellows. You might think they were nobles. Well, what do you think? They make soldiers of all classes there. But they don't understand our talk at all, said the dancer with a puzzled smile. I asked him whose subject he was, and he jabbered his own way. A queer lot. But it's strange, friends, continued the man who had wondered at their whiteness. The peasants at Moshaysk were saying that when they began burying the dead, where the battle was, you know, well, those dead had been lying there for nearly a month. And, says the peasant, they lie as white as paper, clean, and not as much smell as a puff of powder smoke. Was it from the cold? Asked someone. You're a clever fellow, from the cold indeed. Why, it was hot. If it had been from the cold, ours would have rotted, would not have rotted, either. But, he says, go up to ours, and they are all rotten and maggoty. So, he says, we tie our faces up with kerchiefs and turn our heads away as we drag them off. We can hardly do it, but theirs, he says, are white as paper, and not so much smell as a whiff of gunpowder. All were silent. It must be from their food, said the sergeant major. They used to gobble the same food as the gentry. No one contradicted him. That peasant near Moshaysk, where the battle was, said the men were all called up from 10 villages around and carted for 20 days and still didn't finish carting the dead away. And as for the wolves, he says, that was a real battle, said an old soldier. It's the only one worth remembering, but since that, it's only been tormenting folk. And do you know, Daddy, the day before yesterday we ran at them, and my word, they didn't let us get near before they just threw down their muskets and went on their knees. Pardon, they say. That's only one case. They say Platov took Pauline himself twice. But he didn't know the right charm. He catches him and catches him. No good. He turns into a bird in his hands and flies away, and there's no way of killing him either. You're a first-class liar, Kisev. When I come to look at you. Liar indeed, it's the real truth. If he fell into my hands when I'd caught him, I'd bury him in the ground with an aspen stake to fix him down. What a lot of men he's ruined. Well, anyway, we're going to end it. He won't come here again, remarked the old soldier, yawning. The conversation flagged and the soldiers began settling down to sleep. Look at the stars, it's wonderful how they shine. You would think the women had spread out their linen, said one of the men, gazing with admiration at the Milky Way. That's a sign of good harvest next year. We shall want some more wood. You warm your back and your belly gets frozen, that's queer. Oh, Lord. What are you pushing for? Is the fire only for you? Look how he's sprawling. In the silence that ensued, the snoring of those who had fallen asleep could be heard. Others turned over and warmed themselves, now and again exchanging a few words. From a campfire 100 paces off came a sound of general, merry laughter. Hark at them roaring there in the 5th company, said one of the soldiers, and what a lot of them they are. One of the men got up and went over to the fifth company. "They're having such fun," said he, coming back. "Two Frenchies have turned up, one's quite frozen and the other's an awful swaggerer. He's singing songs."
"Oh,
I'll go across and have a look." And several of the men went over to the fifth company.
Alright, there we go, another chapter down. Not sure who we're hanging out with here. And that chapter had a lot of dialogue, but very few tags to say who was speaking, so I apologise if that was a bit confusing. There was quite a few paragraph marks in there where it was skipping between different people speaking, but didn't say, said this person or said that person. It just skipped between them. So it might not have read. I was thinking of even adding in some markers to show different people speaking, but I hope it still made a bit of sense. Chattelvelster said, "If we look back to Tolstoy's theory that an army's force equals its mass times its spirit, we can see that the most joyous person contributes the most to the force. Because this chapter contains a number of joyous people and actions, who or what in this chapter contributed the most to the force?" Well, that 5th Regiment, was it 5th Regiment? 5th Commandment? 5th something? 5th Company seems to be very cheerful. But that theory, I don't know, like Petya was quite cheerful. He was very enthusiastic, very happy to be there. But probably not that much of a force in the army. Pretty useless, really. I don't think he really achieved anything. And I don't think that theory really holds true, is it? That, like, only, like, it reminded me of when antibiotics kill off a virus, you know. If you don't finish the course, it's like only the strongest cells of that virus remain, right? And then so if they multiply again, the virus comes back stronger. And Tolstoy was almost saying it was like that, like only the weakest of the army had died, leaving only strong, cheerful, motivated, happy, and spirited members of the army. But it just doesn't seem realistic. Like, they're freezing, they've got no rations, they've got no, you know, their clothing's falling apart. Two-thirds of their comrades have died around them. And we're supposed to believe that they're just, they're only the happy ones remain. It just doesn't, I just kind of don't buy it. I don't doubt that they were cheerful though. Because you can sometimes have these weird moments of, it's like gallows humor almost. Where when things get real dire. And it's that, I don't know, it's almost like they can see the end in sight. They know they're the last survivors. They know things can't get any worse. And they can see, you know, one of them even said, "We're getting double rations soon. When this is all over, we're getting double rations." And it's not far off. He threw the sole of his boot into the fire because he, rather than, you know, tie it back onto his shoe, because he can see the end. We're nearly there and we're going to get all this great stuff. And I think it's just made them a bit giddy. And you've got that weird happiness and that weird sense of humour that shines through in these awful dark moments. Chattelvelster said, "In the PNV translation, the weak people are described as being thrown out of the army. Does this mean they are being sent home, or does thrown out mean something more final?" Yeah, I think it might mean something more final. I can't remember the word that was used. Let me just quickly have a flick back. In the Maud translation, it said sifted out of the army, which has a little bit more of a final connotation to it, doesn't it? They were sifted out of the army. Disposed of, it sounds like, when you say sifted out. So I think that's, yeah, I don't think they were kicked out. I think they were killed. Or they died out, died off in some other way. Lastly, Chattelvelster said, "A soldier tells the rest that he heard that the French corps didn't stink and that Napoleon was taken twice but flew away after turning into a bird. Where do these rumours come from, and why do they seem positive towards the French? Well, I think they've got a lot of respect for the French, you know. Remember at the start of the book, in the soirees, it was very fashionable to have been to France. And a lot of the upper, upper class of Russia didn't even speak Russian. They only spoke French. French was the most sophisticated, the classiest, the most civilized place, civilization on earth. So I don't think the Russians hate French lifestyle. I think they actually aim to replicate it quite a lot. And I think that was a pretty universal thing. The French were fancy. So they are the enemy, but it's like, I think we're so used to the narrative around a war being the enemy is like scum, right? Because all the recent wars, it's always, that's the way they frame it. Even World War One and Two, it's like the enemy was vermin, you know. I think the thing to remember is that in this case, that it was much different. The Russians actually quite admired their enemy. I think that too had something to do with, remember when Maya was trying to escape just after her father died, and they were trying to pack, but there was no horses, and all the peasants were refusing to pack the horses for her. This is when Nikolai came to the rescue. But the peasants had received some propaganda from the French saying, you know, when we take over, everything's going to be a lot better. There's nothing to fear. We're going to be very kind and generous rulers, all the rest. And probably true. It's probably the case. And it's why those peasants were so willing to shrug their shoulders and go, yeah, okay, that sounds pretty good. Because the French weren't barbaric. They had a lot of resources. And they, like I said, they were quite posh. They were quite fancy. So if you've got to get ruled by anyone, this very civilized, and by all accounts, fair and honorable enemy is not a bad choice. I think that's going to do us for today. Thank you all very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.